The Natural Nurse with Ellen Kamai and Dr. Z, Mondays at 1 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Welcome, listeners, to another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. This is Dr. Z, Dr. Eugene Zamprone, here with another edition of the program, and we're really excited to have on Dr. Kathleen Albertson, who is a licensed acupuncturist, herbalist, and has her PhD, and she is the author of a fabulous new book, Acupuncture and Chinese Herbal Medicine for Women's Health, Bridging the Gap Between Western and Eastern Medicine. And this book is very interesting because it looks at and tries to, again, like the title says, bridge the gap between a very ancient and complex type of medicine, traditional Chinese medicine, and how we would understand health from a Western perspective. It also looks at gynecologic, reproductive, and other disorders that we commonly see in practice here, such as painful menstruation, PCOS, pregnancy, perimenopause, insomnia, even heart disease, which, of course, is really increasing in women. And we're really interested in having her on. So without further ado, Dr. Albertson.
Hi, Dr. Z and everyone out there. Thank you for having me. It's a pleasure.
Oh, great to hear from you. Tell us a little bit about your background and how you managed to write a book. You know, I've written several books, and I know how hard it is to write a book, how much time goes into it. So, and this is a fabulous introduction and also advanced treatise on Chinese medicine for people, making it simple.
Well, that's the hard part, trying to take Chinese theory in Americans. But I really value educating patients and helping them be proactive and helping them focus on prevention. And I grew up in Buffalo, New York. I'm an Italian, so it's good to hear all of your Eastern accents as I sit here in California. I had no exposure to Asian medicine or anything other than Western medicine. You know, if I banged my head, my mother would say, go put some ice on it, you know. And I had no exposure at all. So in graduate school, I had a major water skiing accident and messed up my back and went through years in business carrying suitcases and doing the corporate marketing routine with a bad back. And one day somebody said acupuncture might help you. And I went and visited a school, and lo and behold, I was mesmerized by the concept of holistic care, how this something so simple could fix my chronic pain that I suffered with for so many years. So I went home and I told my husband, I'm going to be an acupuncturist. And luckily he said, yes, dear, and my journey continued. But I really think it's important to educate people, and what I find is that acupuncture is becoming more mainstream and that we need to educate our patients on the value of it. It's often undervalued and underutilized in prevention.
A lot's happened since President Nixon first kind of brought that to our attention. Actually, one of his aides was sick, and they were in China, I believe, and he experienced acupuncture, the aide, and was so impressed by it that they opened up a whole opened it up to the east.
Right.
To the west, excuse me. Yeah.
And John Reston from the New York Times began writing about it.
Right.
And that's how the Caucasian world became familiar with it, because I think prior to that it was a mystery.
Yeah.
You know, people had very stereotypes of what it was and had no exposure, because it was basically done in Asian communities and pockets where people would not have any reason to consider it as an alternative.
Right. And then, you know, as a licensed acupuncturist like yourself, you go through quite a bit of school. Tell the listeners what type of schooling it takes to become a licensed acupuncturist.
Right. It's a master's program, 3 years, and we study pharmacology, we study Western anatomy, as well as all of the Chinese theory. We have 2,500 to 3,000 clinical hours, And then we sit for a state board, and in our case out in California, or even in New York State, the boards are very difficult. The year I took it, it was like a 28% pass rate.
Yes, I've heard.
Very difficult.
I've heard that California is a tough place to get licensed, which is great, mm-hmm. because it shows you that you guys really know your stuff and you've been practicing. So Chinese medicine encompasses more than just acupuncture. Tell us about traditional Chinese medicine and all the things that a acupuncturist actually can avail themselves to help bring someone back into balance.
Okay. We use the word traditional Chinese medicine, or TCM, because it includes acupuncture and herbal medicine and nutritional guidance, as well as some body massage and things like that. So many times when people think of Chinese medicine, they might just think, oh, herbs, but it actually encompasses the acupuncture as well as the herbs, and more important, nutrition and lifestyle guidance, which sometimes we don't get from Western medicine until it's too late.
Yes, absolutely. And so let's talk a little bit about Chinese medicine and a little bit about its history. I know I teach history of medicine, and I always talk about the Emperor Shennong.
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And how he actually maybe used bones or fragments of things like minerals or shards.
Right.
And probably, I mean, we don't really know how acupuncture was probably discovered.
Right. We were taught that in the fishing villages, and acupuncture in Chinese medicine is 5,000 years old versus Western medicine, which is about 200 years old, or even chiropractic, which is about 100 plus years old, but that in the villages in China, they would sharpen stones and then place those sharpened stones into certain areas of the body to, like, bloodlet, much like Western medicine started. And as they began seeing responses in the body, they started putting together the point theory and realizing that, oh, the body has, like, acupuncture points and circuit boards that I can put a sharp needle or stone in one area of the hand, and that can affect leg movement. And so they started making those correlations. But the Chinese were the first to take deceased prisoners, and open up the body to look at the blood vessel system and lymph system and realize that, hey, this body is a schematic, and it's not just the body, but the brain is a major component. And that's why we consider it holistic, mind, body, spirit.
The other holistic principle that really looks at the energetics of the body is the concept of qi. Now, mm-hmm. I know it's a very hard thing for the Western mind to get around, but try your best to talk about qi.
Qi is your life force. It's the energy in your body that allows you to blink your eyes, to breathe, to move forward. Another aspect of qi is your energetic personality. Like, sometimes you'll walk into a room and you'll say, oh, I like this person, or this person has negative energy. So it actually has to do with the health rays or energies around the body. And the concept is that qi, this life force, and blood flow through the body through circuit boards called acupuncture pathways or meridians. And when qi and blood flow evenly, there's no pathology. So some people have a lot of qi. You meet people with a lot of energy. They're very excited and have a lot of personality, and other people are very weak and they have a low demeanor and low voice and weak voice and shallow breath. So qi changes. We're born with a certain amount of qi from our mother and our father, and we have our own qi, and then that qi begins to disintegrate or deteriorate over life as we age.
So we have the prenatal qi,
which
we get from our parents. That would be kind of, I guess, the rudimentary understanding of some of genetics and inborn errors of metabolism and sort
DNA.
Of what we look at, that DNA, the maternal DNA and things like that. But then we also have the nutritive qi, or the gu qi,
mm-hmm.
which that's pretty important, because that has to do with our diet, our the way we eat, our relationship with foods, and how we assimilate or absorb. You know, they always say in holistic medicine, you are what you absorb.
Uh-huh. And in the when we take in food, it goes to the stomach and spleen in Chinese medicine, and then that energy is transformed and transmuted into nutrition, into the blood cells throughout the body so that it can feed the entire system. And when there's blockages or the qi is not in balance, then there's problems with absorption, which creates disease.
So qi and blood are related to each other in Chinese medicine. I know that.
Correct. It's like the yin and the yang. If you have too much qi, that's not good for the blood. If you have too much blood, it's not good for the qi. The idea is to balance and make sure that qi and blood are smooth and in balance so that the body can properly function and you can maximize your health.
So now that in Chinese medicine, there's a very interesting concept of the eight principles.
Mm-hmm.
Tell
mm-hmm.
us about that, because that's very key to understanding Chinese medicine and, of course, the whole pathological system.
Right. So when a patient comes into our office, we will have them fill out typical medical paperwork and ask them, you know, their signs and symptoms, how's their sleep, how's their digestion. We will look at their tongue and their pulse, and with their tongue and pulse, we will make some analysis of their state of qi and blood and the state of the organs in the body. And we organize this information into what we call the eight patterns. And those patterns are excess and deficiency, for example. Like some people are very robust and have too much stuff going on in the body, while other people are more deficient. Hot and cold is another category. Some people run more hot or have more hot diseases versus cold. And we just begin organizing into the eight patterns that we effectively then come up with a treatment protocol.
Right, right. And then, of course, yin and yang is very critical. That's sort of during the Confucius era. That's when this very interesting concept of yin and yang, and, you know, people like wear medallions of yin and yang. They have, you know, bumper stickers. But that's a very critical component in Chinese medicine. Can you comment on that?
Yes, yin and yang are part of the eight principles. So I mentioned deficiency and excess, hot and cold, yin and yang. The yin refers more to the body's material aspects, like body fluids, blood, and to like the interior or inferior, below the waist aspects of the body. Cold is a yin characteristic. Deficiency are yin in nature. And they also relate to the denser organs, liver, heart, things like that in the body. And yang is more airy, yang is more energetic, like the lungs are an empty organ. They're considered a yin, but are yang in nature.
Mm-hmm. Because of the movements of them, constant movements of them.
Constant movements and more related to exterior diseases, warm characteristics. Somebody who is considered yang, men in general are considered more yang because they run more warm, are more robust. Women are considered more yin because of menstrual cycles, having more blood issues,
right,
that kind of thing.
So now we also have the different organs mm-hmm. systems in Chinese medicine, which I think is very important to understand before we get actually into some of the women's imbalances, the nature of your book.
Mm-hmm.
The kidneys. Now, when you say the kidneys to a Western person, they just think of the, you know, kidney bean-shaped organs in our body that filter urine and make hormones and are involved in detoxification and whatnot. But it's much more different in Chinese medicine.
Right. Usually when we say kidneys is adrenals and excretion functions. But kidneys is the root of all the qi that we discussed earlier. And in Chinese medicine, the kidney system connects with the heart system and the mind, so that the kidneys are actually considered the origin of skill and intelligence. So right there's a correlation with it's not just like adrenal. If somebody has overworked adrenals, they're exhausted. That can affect their brain function, their attitude, their level of energy. So in Chinese medicine, kidneys are the root of energy. And the nerve roots in the back, in the low back, the kidney area, connect to the uterus. And so many menstruation problems or fertility problems are treated by restoring the kidney essence, we would say.
Hmm. What about the back of the legs? I know there's a patient of mine that we'll talk about. I'm going to ask you a couple of cases, actually. Maybe we can put our heads together. But I know when the qi is deficient of the kidneys, Uh-huh. Women would have, or men too for that matter sometimes, would have frequent urination.
Right.
They might complain of a pain in their back all the time.
Mm-hmm. Low back pain. And sometimes that type of pain is dull and aching. You'll say, well, do you have, you know, what kind of back pain do you have? And they'll say, well, it's kind of dull and aching and bothersome because it means the kidneys are deficient, going back to the eight patterns, where somebody who was kicking a ball on the weekend or skating and fell down would have more acute, more excessive, stagnant-type pain. So,
I see.
When we're looking at the kidneys and trying to come up with this diagnosis, we're looking at the nature of the pain, how it fits into those eight patterns, and then where exactly in the channels is the origin. So low back could also be urinary bladder channel.
Oh, okay. So the weekend warrior syndrome, like you mentioned, is more of a stagnation type of thing?
Right. We would say that they fell down and they hurt their back or their leg muscles and they were bruised and the muscle spasmed and that area became stagnant with blood.
Oh, I see.
And so we would use a protocol that would remove the blood stagnation, soothe the liver and liver qi, because liver is ligaments and tendons. So that's another system that has several different functions than we think of it in Western medicine.
Right.
We would try to move out that stagnation and restore the circulation in that area, reduce the inflammation.
Now, the spleen would be the next interesting organ. Again, we think of the spleen as, you know, something that maybe is involved with red blood cells and formation of somewhat of the immune system. But in Chinese, the spleen is tied into digestion, too.
Right, digestion, and because we take in food and the spleen and the stomach then transport it, the spleen actually creates the quality of the qi in the blood in the body, and it keeps the blood in the vessel. Some people that have varicose veins or bruise easily, we would say they have spleen qi deficiency, that the blood can't be held in the vessels, and that is the function of the spleen.
Oh.
Fatigue would be a function of the spleen. Sometimes bloating and abdominal pain, things like that, poor appetite, are deficiency in the spleen.
And I know when the qi of the spleen is low, people have a weakness. They complain of. Now, could it be weakness in just some parts of their body? Like, what happens if they have, again, back to my patient, we'll get into them, but they tend to complain of weakness in the legs only.
Right. Well, the spleen is spleen is supporting qi and blood, so the circulation or the quality of the blood could be weak.
Oh.
Like if we looked at the blood under a microscope, like in a phase contrast or live blood cell, the blood would probably be kind of empty in the center. So we would want to nourish the blood to help improve the circulation in the lower body.
Interesting.
And aching leg pain would be a sign of deficiency versus sharp stabbing pain.
Right.
But a lot of times when they have a deficiency in the spleen, they then sometimes suffer from coldness, or they drink or eat a lot of cold foods that shuts the spleen down. The spleen doesn't like cold, icy drinks, and so they're aggravating their situation by what they're eating.
That's certainly a habit I know that many Americans, if they go out to dinner or whatever, the waitress brings a big pitcher of ice water, and I know that's frowned upon in traditional Chinese medicine.
Right, because if it shuts down the center of the body, then it cannot transport your nutrition. So you're not absorbing, and then we have more metabolic problems.
Mm-hmm.
And if their spleen is deficient, it can then turn into an excess situation where some people then have bloating, but then they have more stomach problems. They start putting on weight, and the metabolic function starts deteriorating because the spleen isn't functioning right. So if somebody comes in with digestion problems or abdominal pain or appetite issues, we're looking at the spleen as the origin of that, but it could also be in combination with other organ systems. So it's never just a clear-cut one organ system is the answer usually.
And that often actually leads to sometimes the metabolic syndrome we're talking about with pre-diabetic conditions and things
like
that.
Right. In Western medicine, typically we'll just, you have acid stomach, let's put you on some Pepcid. Acid blockers. Let's just treat the acid. We want to ask them, are you tired? How do you sleep?
Right.
How is your digestion? Any diarrhea? Those are all signs that the system's not working. Even constipation would mean that the spleen is not nourishing the blood which moistens the intestines, which helps bowel movements.
Mm-hmm. So now, the liver, function. We always hear about the liver, like the liver, you know, cleans the blood, and it is a big kind of filtration device in our body. It makes all kinds of different nutrients and vitamins, but it's even associated with emotions in Chinese medicine.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the emotion of the liver is anger or irritability. So in Chinese medicine, they would say, oh, you are quick to anger. And that means that the liver system, which it does metabolize in Western medicine as we know it, but in Chinese medicine, the liver controls the even flow of qi in blood. And it controls ligaments, it controls menstruation. And when there is an imbalance from stress, which is also a mechanism of the liver, the energy begins to move erratically and can shoot over and aggravate the stomach, shoot up and create headaches or high blood pressure, or that burst of energy to the head creates anger.
What I love about your book is that you actually list, like, many of the Western symptoms that somebody would have, and you categorize them according to the Chinese. That's very important, because people find that their signs and symptoms are mysterious or have no connections with other illnesses. They might come in with 20 different problems. I got an ache here, pain here. I got a headache here. I have PMS here, or my menses are very heavy. And the Chinese doctor connects the dots. That's what I love about these ancient systems of medicine, Kathleen.
The liver is so important. We know that it metabolizes and it filters, but like a patient might come in with, oh, yeah, they're under stress from work, and they have eczema, and they're tired, and they're crabby, and they have, PMS, and we immediately know that it's a liver system problem, because if the liver is not filtering, and if that liver energy is not moving evenly, and the blood is not moving evenly and being filtered, toxins can accumulate in the liver. They have nowhere to go, so they spill into the blood and ultimately to the skin. So many times we see eczema, psoriasis, skin rashes, hives, related to liver problems.
Absolutely.
And so we don't treat it topically. We're treating the inside with great results. And when I look at the children today and I see how many children come into my practice with eczema, and the first thing we look at is the spleen. Is the spleen making blood and qi properly, so that stomach function and spleen function are working? And then what's the liver doing with it? Because it means there's just excess. The lymph and everything's not filtering.
Now, does acupuncture hurt for those that are kind of squeamish of needles? I'm sure you get that question every day.
The first question. Yeah, when I do talks, I usually stand up and hold a needle in my hand, and I say, can you see this? And of course, many can't see it because they're in the back. And I'll say, "See what you can't see can't hurt you." There's a slight pinch, but the needle is so thin, and they differ very much from Western medicine needles. So, but generally, they don't. There's a quality of needles. Your practitioner can spend anywhere from 3 cents to 11 cents on a needle. So, a good needle is like a good pair of shoes. It's going to fit correctly.
Absolutely, and different sizes for different things in different areas.
Right. So if somebody is sensitive, then I think it's important to adapt to that patient so that they feel comfortable, because the qi is there. It's not necessarily that you have to stimulate everything to the hilt and cause pain, which may have been older thinking, years and years ago. Now, in China, they still use reusable needles because they don't have the luxury of sterile, single-use, disposable needles.
Wow.
And when I was in China, they're very large, very long, and since they sterilize them and reuse them, they're very dull. So I said no thanks.
Yeah, exactly. They probably hurt going in, I'm sure.
Yeah, but it's interesting, the fortitude of the patients in that clinic. There was one, I remember one 11-year-old boy who had astigmatism in his eye, and his father brought him every day to the clinic, and they did points. They would actually kind of move the eye over and go into the inner canthus, the inner portion of the eye, and eventually, maybe 15, 20 treatments, his eyesight was perfect. He didn't need glasses.
Wow.
He stood there as the brave soldier, never said a word, and took his treatment.
Man.
And I'm thinking that would never happen in America.
Right. Well, let's talk about some of the problems coming into your office quite commonly. What would you say is of the many illnesses that you discussed or patterns you discussed in your book, what would be the number one reason why women would seek traditional Chinese medicine?
Most of the women that I see, I specialize in fertility. So when they're coming to me, they're maybe in their mid-30s and have a successful career, education, and they're married now and they're ready to have children. And they've controlled everything in their life, and now they want to control when they're going to get pregnant, and it doesn't happen. They might have prolonged use of birth control.
Right.
Or prolonged stress over work, which, you know, causes a lot of imbalances in the body. Or they may have been drinking too much coffee, too much wine, too many late dinners, and they want pregnancy on demand. And, of course, that's not an option today. So we work on restoring their menstrual cycles, reducing their stress and fatigue, and getting them on more nutritional programs so that they can conceive naturally, because the body needs to be in balance. The kidney system and the endocrine system and the heart have to be congruent. They have to feel that the body is safe. So one mechanism of the acupuncture is that it aligns that. And we have, you know, many, many successes. Other women would come while they're in process of seeing a fertility specialist for in vitro. And there are studies that show 40 to 60% improvement in pregnancy rates when acupuncture is used as an adjunct.
Right, like some of them. In some issues, there's tubal factors, like I'm reading page 207 of your book. Sometimes there's a lot of ovarian dysfunction.
Okay. Right. Mm-hmm.
Maybe the ovaries are getting too old or whatnot.
Right.
Endometriosis,
right,
which we'll maybe touch on in a bit. Maybe male factors. It could be the male partner, too.
Right. But I think, you know, the biggest reason is because women are waiting longer to get pregnant because of careers.
Right.
And then you add nutrition, stress, toxins in the environment, and the body is out of alignment, imbalanced.
So,
but we have great success, and that's mostly what I see. But I think the most common thing that most people would seek acupuncture for is pain, you know, neck pain, back pain, that kind of thing. But
right,
we see a lot of that as well.
Interesting. So let's talk a little bit about how you might treat somebody with infertility, say. I know there's a lot of herbs. Do you use herbs, too?
Yes. Uh-huh.
Okay.
Very, very important part, I believe.
So there's certain points, of course, that you might use. Now, have these points, these protocols where an acupuncturist will needle certain points, They've been looked at by many Chinese studies, like, you know, if you needle the conception vessel, which runs
right
in the front of the thing, and of course you do other points, that will enhance the fertility. So tell us a little bit about how acupuncture is studied, because how do they run a placebo if somebody's getting an acupuncture treatment, because everyone's getting the needles.
Right. It's very difficult I think acupuncture studies are often criticized because the sample size is too small. It's not double-blind, randomized, not scientific in Western terms.
Mm-hmm.
But when you take 5,000 years of clinical evidence, it stands the test of time. But more often now, in this one study that was done in 2002 by Dr. Paulus, they had 160 patients. 80 was the control group. And the women had acupuncture 25 minutes before their in vitro transfer and 25 minutes after with specific points. And so they compared the control group to the other group, and that's where they had 40 to 60% improvement. 40% was the...
Now, can they just do, I think they call it sham acupuncture, where they have a person that seems to be competent, just put the needles any which way, and the patient feels like they're getting a true treatment, but they're actually, these are random points?
Right, random points. There's a lot of those studies, and they're all over the board. Some of the sham acupuncture points, you know, will say acupuncture doesn't work. You know, we use sham points, and there was no difference from one patient population to another. A recent one was done on with osteoarthritis knee patients, and they had like 417 patients, which is a good base. And they tested the communication of the acupuncturist. They both used the same points, but on one group they said, you're going to get well, this really works, versus just telling the patient, this may not work. And the communication significantly changed the outcomes of the treatment. So, you know, when you consider sham acupuncture, there's so many variables. The points are real, and they have important functions, and I think those are proven and stood the test of time. But
do you work with patients with fibromyalgia?
very frequently.
Definitely.
And many times they go undiagnosed for years and years. You know, they have aches and pains, they don't sleep right, they're in a state of depression. With Chinese medicine, we look at the root. Was it a physical trauma or an emotional trauma? Sometimes it was an accident, sometimes it was a divorce or a bad relationship, and the body goes into a spiral. And until they have certain points of pain and certain sleep habits, or lack of sleep habits, the doctors can't diagnose them, and then they start treating the symptoms. So one starts treating the pain, one starts treating the depression. Pretty soon the person's on a lot of medication. Well, she'll never get out of the hole unless she begins nutrition and alternative care, in my opinion.
So I have you seen different subgroups of fibromyalgia, and what would they be, you feel, in your practice?
Mostly pain, you know, extensive pain all over the body, and sleep, you know, they're not sleeping right, and so, of course, without sleep, you're in rest, your body can't nourish itself. So usually it's pain and sleep and then emotional trauma, and those components can be addressed, and many times very, very successfully. So what I like about acupuncture and herbal medicine is that you don't need a diagnosis coming in. You might feel terrible. You might feel fatigued, have aches and pains, and your doctor says, you're fine, go home and rest. But if you come to an acupuncturist, they're going to check your tongue, your pulse, and treat the symptoms, and they can treat multiple symptoms at the same time.
So we're going to hear the music. We're going to take a quick break. You can get a nice drink. No ice, though.
No ice, right? Well, it's 100 degrees here today, so maybe ice.
Oh, okay. Well, you need the ice, but it's cold on the east here where I am. So we'll be back with more of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z in a second.
Thank you.
This is PRN, Progressive Radio Network.
Hello! Check out my show, The Animal Magnet Pet Radio, live every Tuesday at 1 p.m. Eastern on Progressive Radio Network. Or catch it anytime you like by scrolling through the archives. You'll hear me, Deborah Wolf, best-selling author and award-winning radio host, chatting with the best pet experts and animal A-listers in the world about controversial topics like breed bans, the indoor versus outdoor cat debate, and whatever else is hot in the news and on their minds that matters to animals and the people who love them. Plus, we tell pet jokes, we'll give you trivia and smart, quirky facts, recipes, and take-home tricks and tests, homework your pets will love. Email your pet problems to me and we'll solve them on air. So listen to The Animal Magnet on Progressive Radio Network and get your animal fix.
The shaky economy, peak oil, and now an unstable climate. Get the inside story with Alex Smith on Radio EcoShock. Top scientists find a looming catastrophe while activists try for change. Experts, authors, and alternative media from around the world and around the corner. Hear it all. Radio EcoShock every Saturday afternoon at 2 o'clock. Listen free and live free right here on PRN, ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com.
Hi, you're listening to Bhavani, and I'd like to welcome you every Wednesday on the Progressive Radio Network to join me for my show called I Eat Green, where every Wednesday we will talk about eating healthy and eating sustainably for our planet. So join me every Wednesday from 5 to 6.
Hi, this is Karen Hartglass, and I am a vegan. No, I am not an alien from planet Vega. I simply choose to eat plant-based foods. Join me on Ask a Vegan every Sunday at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time. We'll be talking about everything from soup to nuts. Plant-based foods are the healthiest foods to eat, as well as being the most economical, the most compassionate, and the least destructive. If you want to know more about the healthy, planet-friendly, plant-based diet, call in with your questions or call in and share your favorite vegan recipes. Tune in on Sunday at 7 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on www.progressiveradionetwork.com.
Progressive Radio Network, information for the independent mind.
And we're back with more of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. This is Dr. Eugene Zamperl and Dr. Z. And we have with us Dr. Kathleen Albertson. She's a licensed acupuncturist and has her doctorate in nutrition. And she's the author of Acupuncture and Chinese Herbal Medicine for Women's Health, Bridging the Gap Between Western and Eastern Medicine. Welcome back.
Thank you, Dr. Z.
Listen, I have a huge amount of patients in my office with insomnia.
Mm-hmm.
Many of the women are, of course, going through the change. Mm-hmm. But Chinese medicine doesn't treat all insomniacs the same way. They differentiate them into different categories. Can you tell the listeners how you would approach insomnia, the different types, and how you would work them up and treat them?
Sure. Most often, the most common insomnia is situational. You know, I'm selling my house, I'm going through a lot, and I wake up and I can't get to sleep. So they can't get to sleep because their minds are very busy. Or another case might be that they go to sleep, but they wake up frequently.
Yes.
So in Chinese, or they don't sleep soundly, you know, or they wake up and they're still exhausted. So we look at it by trying to determine, you know, what is the aspect? Is it the fact that the heart blood is not calming the blood so that the person can sleep, or is it the liver energy from stress causing them to be overactive and stay awake? So we check their tongue and their pulse, and we can determine through asking the questions, you know, how do you sleep? When do you wake up? When do you go back to sleep? How difficult is it? We can set up a pattern of treatment that will treat it. So the herbs would be different also.
For
one person who has trouble falling asleep versus another staying. Some people run warm if it's a menopausal issue. But then we're not treating just the heart blood or the liver blood, but we're treating kidneys, because kidneys is part of aging and deterioration. And we want to nourish the kidneys so that the kidneys then can continue to make good blood so that the body stays calm. So it's usually deficiency, but sometimes it's excess situations that the liver is causing too much energy to get warm and hot that shoots up to the head, and the person is anxious and can't sleep.
What's the best herbs for the kidney?
Well, in Chinese medicine, we just don't give you like one or two herbs, or we don't treat with single herbs. So we would make a formula.
Good point. Yep.
Of Chinese herbs. So a lot of times people will be coming in and say, oh, I'm taking melatonin to sleep, you know, or I take I take calcium and magnesium to help me sleep, but it's just not enough. So one good thing is that most often the herbs don't complicate or counteract Western nutritional supplements. But we do ask questions. Are you on blood thinners? Are you on cholesterol meds? Before we make any type of herbal formula for the person. But because it's unique to that person, there could be a wide variety of words of herbs, and I can give you the Chinese names, but you might not know Suanzao Ren or Ji Shui Tang, because I know the pinyin names, and not the Latin names.
Yeah, we were trained. It's funny, when I trained in Chinese medicine, we trained in the Latin too. And
right, I found it easier to learn the pinyin, so that's what I stick with. And for the listeners, we a practitioner can translate we have to look, like if you've trained in one aspect of it, you can always
like Shu De Huang, right? Romania.
Yeah, right, yeah,
Shu
De Huang.
That's a big one for the blood and yin, I believe.
Da Zhao, Sheng Di Wang, you know, so I know those words, you know, rather than saying Romania or Gochitsa, which is lycee berry, things like that.
Right.
So I don't think we'll get anywhere if you want me to get
No, that's okay. That's okay.
I think the point is, because the formula is unique, that we're taking in the patient's characteristics and symptoms, the formula is going to work better.
Right. Like, for instance, if they have, like in your book here, on one, you say heart kidney yin deficiency, so you say insomnia with frequent waking, heat sensation or night sweats, heart palpitations, dryness, because I guess if they're low in yin, they're going to be on the dry side.
Right, and that heat from like perimenopausal heat or menopausal heat dries up the body fluids.
And they even get cracks in their tongue because of the dryness.
Right. And it's interesting that when you start asking a patient these questions, they don't correlate the symptoms.
No.
Like sleep and menopause, they might have a broad brush idea that they're related, but when you say, do you have vaginal dryness? Do you wake up thirsty?
Mm.
And then when we check their pulse, we're getting key notes on the pulse that are telling us, yeah, this is a rapid, like rapid as heat going through the body. We hear that underneath our fingers. So
also different times, like difficulty falling asleep between 2 to 4. That's like when many of these people are waking up 2 to 4 a.m. and then they can't get back to sleep after that. And
right.
That has to do with the liver.
Right, the liver system, which stress and overwork are the precursors to so many problems that when we get those under control, which is fairly relatively easy to do, without a lot of medications and not a lot of time, the body functions better, and it's going to naturally rest.
Now, with putting the acupuncture needles in the different points,
mm-hmm.
Would you treat based on putting the needle in where it hurts? For instance, they call that
ashi points.
The ashi, exactly.
Yeah.
Or would you treat by balancing the other organs that are associated that either increase or decrease, the mother-son relationship? I didn't want to get too
right.
crazy because I don't know if the listeners would really understand that, but maybe you can talk a little bit about it.
Sure. Well, if we're treating pain, somebody comes in with a back sprain, neck pain, many times we'll do actual points that have certain functions to move the blood, reduce the inflammation, help calm the muscles,
mm-hmm.
And those are and then we'll add some of our own points that are just in the areas of the pain. It's not like a recognized point. It's not on the map, so to speak.
Right.
But we know that by being in the vicinity, it's going to give us results. So those are called ashi, which means like just pain points. But if we're treating something like insomnia, many times we're balancing. We're using kidney points, a kidney 3 point, which is on the inside of the ankle to help nourish the kidney blood.
Right,
and
near the ankle bone
heart
there.
Point, right, a heart point on the outside of the wrist, to balance the heart. And then also always there's in between the web of your thumb and your index finger on both hands and the web and your second toe.
The large intestine, right?
Large intestine. Yeah, and liver 3 and LI4
right.
are called the four gates of qi.
Right.
And I use those points a lot because they calm the liver energy.
So what are they again? You have large intestine 4 between the thumb and the index finger.
Right, and liver 3, which is in between the web between your big toe and your second toe.
Okay, yeah, those are very important.
You can rub
those.
The listeners can actually do acupressure on those points to calm stress down on the body or help their bodies relax on themselves or even on their children.
Now, another condition we see quite a bit is a PMS, where women are getting severe cramps, heavy menses, also
crabbiness.
Yeah.
Irritability.
I didn't want to say it because I didn't want to get in
women
trouble.
Will tell, it's so funny. Like sometimes the men will say, she's crabby, take care of her. But the women will know, I'm not myself. I don't feel good about being.
So why is that happening? I mean, we know, trained in bio-Western medicine, but how do the Chinese see it?
Well, it really puts together how the organ systems in these pathways fit, because the liver system starts on the feet, right around near where we talked about the point, liver 3 on the toe,
right.
And it comes up through the uterus, through the breasts, to the head. So that's the pathway. That's the road that it follows.
Mm.
And prior to menstruation, conceptually, the blood is trying to pool together to exit, because the liver controls the even flow of blood. And when that liver is out of balance, that system is out of balance, it can't pool the blood evenly. It's having a little trouble. So it begins to pull and push and move that blood erratically, which causes swelling in the channel from, like, the uterus, where you start feeling cramps or low back pain, breast tenderness, sometimes headachy or insomnia or crabbiness. So that channel is filling up with fluids, causing it to be out of balance, and it overreacts. Once you get your cycle, that channel calms down, back to normal.
Now, some women get swollen.
Mm-hmm.
Their tongue gets swollen.
That's fluid retention.
Body, they get edema or something. What's that? What would that pattern be?
that's also, well, if it's part of premenstrual cycle, it's because the fluids are loaded in the channel, and the liver channel goes through the tongue, as well as the heart channel.
I see.
And so it's just a matter, just like the breast get tender, that's just a swelling and fluids in that channel causing pain, you know, or they get bloated. That's another factor. They feel really bloated PMS-wise.
I had one lady who actually developed, like, rage during the menses, like real Dr. Jekyll, Mr. Hyde type of behavior.
Right. We would call that liver fire. So not only is the liver stagnant or stuck, but it becomes hot and toxic and moves even faster, more rapidly, creating heat, which causes more fire and rage. So she blows. She blows her gasket, in a sense.
Now, you listed foods that sort of balance the body. You have a nice chart here in the beginning of the book. Any foods to kind of calm the liver, or how do the Chinese look at actual diet?
Right. It's very important, because if you're already running warm and hot, and you're eating hot foods like a lot of meat, you know, and alcohol, then that's going to just feed that fire. So we would want to talk to you about cooling foods, which kind of cool the temperatures in the body. You know, more like fruits like cantaloupe or vegetables like asparagus and squash, tomatoes, things like that are cooling.
So watery, cooling. Parsley and those types of things.
Parsley, watermelon, right. But if you can aggravate your condition by eating the wrong temperature.
I was going to say, on the converse, if you see somebody with like back to the fibromyalgia, I often notice that there's a trend. Not that every fibromyalgia case is the same, but I often notice that they have a very pale tongue. Mm-hmm. You can actually see the teeth marks in the tongue.
Right.
Maybe they have a couple cracks in the stomach spleen area.
Mm-hmm.
What's happening with that that fibromyalgia patient, right, and what types of foods should they be avoiding and eating?
It's a deficiency. So when we see teeth marks on the tongue, the tongue is a muscle, and the muscle should lay in the mouth strong. But when there's little ridges or scallop marks around the edge of the tongue, it means that the body is tired. It doesn't even have enough energy to hold the tongue in the mouth strongly, so it relaxes or gravitates towards the teeth and rests against the teeth. So we know they're in a deficiency state. Many times they run cold. So we always ask, do you have cold feet or do you, that kind of thing. And so we would want more warming foods that help circulate the blood and warm the blood. So like, you know, cinnamon tea or warm foods, you know, like lamb is warming, garlic, scallion are more on the warm side. Warm vegetables like cauliflower, black beans, lentils.
So they wouldn't do well with taking things out of the refrigerator and eating like a cold salad or
cold
something
salad,
like
right.
that.
That's why the Chinese add meat. They'll like stir fry, but they'll add a little bit of meat to change the temperature or the properties of the dish, because meat is generally more warming. And it's not how it, like it's hot to the tongue or hot to the mouth, but it's the qualities that the body perceives and utilizes.
Sort of the energetics of that particular
energetics,
food.
Right. Sort of, yeah.
Huh, that's fascinating.
So you can, you know, by the same token, you can help a lot of conditions by asking them what they eat and getting them to make some corrections.
Yeah, so if that person had that flabby, I think that's what they call it, flabby tongue, they might think that they're doing well by eating lots of salads, because, you know, salads are good.
Right.
It's vegetables and whatnot. So how would you realistically, you know, counsel somebody? You might say, well, you know, eating vegetables is okay, but there are certain vegetables you need to avoid, or you need to prepare them a certain way, or
right, change how you prepare them. Many times this kind of person will be doing a lot of dairy and cheese, which is warming. So many times they might say, well, you know, I'm exhausted and I'm holding water, I have water retention, and you find out that a lot of their diet is dairy, meat, cheese. And so you need to get them on good oils and warmer foods, and get, you know, a lot of times they're doing iced tea, Coca-Colas. So the diet is really key to turn the stomach back on. It's been shut off, and so they have a cold stagnation in the stomach,
now,
causing the water to
Some women get bloated very easy, or have digestive problems. So they eat something and they become, their stomach, I had a patient recently that her stomach bloats, like the moment she eats, doesn't even need to eat a lot.
Right.
But
right.
A few bites and she's all bloated and belching. What would that be?
We call it rebellious chi. So the chi is rebelling, just like a bad child. Where we, when we take in food, the chi should go down into our body and transport the energy. But instead, it's rebelling upwards. So sometimes you have burping, heartburn,
right,
or it's extended stomach. So we want to nourish the chi. And sometimes there's not only cold, but dampness in the summer in the stomach.
Yeah. Well, it's funny that she would get that when she ate lots of peanut butter and...
Mm-hmm.
Eggs and fatty foods, she tended
right.
to...
Too greasy and too fatty because her stomach has, energy has been compromised.
Right.
So we need to turn that all around. And another good question with this kind of patient is, I'll ask a patient, do you drink a lot of water? And there's two answers. The patient we're discussing that bloats and maybe eating a lot of meat will say, I'm thirsty, but I really don't drink. I don't drink enough. And the Chinese would say they're thirsty, but they have no desire to drink because the body... becomes lethargic. The fatigue in the body has overtaken the mind, so they're thirsty, but they go for hours and hours before they'll take a sip of water.
That can't be good for your yin, I guess, right?
Right, for the body and the fluids. So that's why they're retaining fluids. Another patient, you'll say, do you drink a lot of water? And they'll say, oh, yes, and I'm thirsty all the time, and I have my water bottle with me. So when I begin to explain that to a patient, that, okay, this is your type, you know, you're thirsty, but you don't have any desire to drink the water, otherwise you would. They go, yeah, I'm kind of thirsty, but by the time I get around to it, you know, it's like 3 hours later. So then we start making them more aware and educating them on the importance of improving the stomach function, using acupuncture and herbs, and, you know, proper nutrition.
Well, again, we're at the tail end of the program with Dr. Kathleen Albertson, licensed acupuncturist, and has her doctorate in nutrition, wrote this great book. I love it because it simplifies traditional Chinese medicine. It's called Acupuncture and Chinese Herbal Medicine for Women's Health. I assume it's available all over the place, Dr. Albertson?
Amazon and through my website, www.orangecountyacupuncture.com.
OrangeCountyAcupuncture.com.
Right. Or just Kathy Albertson will get you to my website.
Wow, thanks very much. A must read for all women and doctors, and we really appreciated your wisdom and enjoyed having you on. We'll have you on again.
Thank you very much, Dr. Z. It's been a pleasure.
Okay, take care.
Have a great day. Bye-bye.
You too. And that does it for another edition of The Natural Nurse and Dr. Z. This is Dr. Z wishing you the best. Stay healthy, folks. Bye-bye.